Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop, where we bring you all the news from Washington, D.C. that the government does not want you to know. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, and we've got a terrific show for you today. We have a special guest. His name is Sheldon Rampton, and he's the author of a book, Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War on Iraq. And I thought that since we heard George Bush on doing his press conference last night, trying very much to explain what he's doing in Iraq, that it would be useful, since, we've been told some things by Bush in the past, it'd be useful to compare what he said in the past and what he says today. Specifically, the role of propaganda, the role of manipulation of facts, of the news, to tell the American people what he thinks we want to hear. I don't know whether that went on last night. I leave that for you to decide. But let's talk a little bit about the press conference before I bring my guest on air. We heard George Bush say that he was staying the course. He was sticking with it, sticking with the war in Iraq. But he wasn't really saying what he planned to do. He was asked if he would have more troops in Iraq, and he said, well, if the generals ask me for more troops in Iraq, I'll have it. What a terrific leader, George Bush. He's going to rely on his generals, and they'll tell him whether or not he needs more troops in Iraq. When asked, how long are we going to stay in Iraq? Well, George Bush, that terrific leader, gave us a specific response. He said, as long as is necessary and not one day more. What stirring rhetoric. You know, I was thinking, having just paid my taxes, I was going to tell the IRS when they asked me, you know, Mark, how much taxes are you going to pay? I was going to say, as much as is necessary and not one penny more. You think they'd accept that? Because, I'd really like to put that on my taxes. One of the interesting things he did is that the question, of course, has been, what are we going to do on June 30th? On June 30th, Bush has said he plans to turn over Iraqi sovereignty to the Iraqis. It's just not clear which Iraqis we're going to turn it over to. But we're turning over sovereignty. Our military's staying there, but Iraqis will be in control. And we got 2.5 months left, and we don't know which Iraqis will be in control. George Bush tried to appoint the Iraqi government. He wanted very much to take Iraq away from one-man government controlled by Saddam Hussein. So instead we had one-man government controlled by George W. Bush. Or maybe it was Dick Cheney. I don't know. But, of course, we know that the provisional government was appointed to a man and a few women by George W. Bush. So he's trying something new. And you know what? I often criticize the president. Let me give him some credit. He's finally listening to John Kerry, which shows that maybe he'll get a brain after all. Maybe his trip to the Wizard of Oz won't be in vain. Because long before now, everyone was complaining Bush has no plan in Iraq, and Republicans, understanding their president had no plan in Iraq, were turning it around. I heard Tucker Carlson on Crossfire say, well, hey, if John Kerry wants to replace him, what's his plan for Iraq? And John Kerry repeated what he'd always said, internationalize the problem, bring in the UN, bring in NATO, let the Iraqis understand that this is not a U.S. occupation of their land, but that this is something that the whole world is coming together to support them. And even if you oppose the Iraq war, which I did, it seems to me that now that we're there, we got to make the best of it. And John Kerry's plan to internationalize it made a lot of sense. In fact, there was a great op-ed by Senator John Kerry, the Democratic nominee, in Tuesday's Washington Post. Well, George Bush apparently can read, or at least his advisors can, because they took John Kerry's plan and they seem to be implementing it. And now George Bush is finally involving the United Nations. He's finally said, who's going to run Iraq? Well, George Bush says that he's going to leave the UN to decide. It's all going to be Lakhdar Brahimi, the United Nations Special Representative to Iraq. And I think that's good. Look, the United Nations is not my favorite organization. It's in many ways it's corrupt. In many ways it has problems. But if you're going to run a country like Iraq, it seems to me that they can do no worse than what we've done. And at the very least, the people of Iraq might well understand, that the UN, at least, is there for their own good. Again, I'm not justifying the war. I'm just saying how I think I might see a way out. There were other interesting things in the press conference, probably my favorite question. And I'm going to be playing for you, by the way, on Sunday. My Sunday show has a new time. It's 7 p.m. I hope those of you that listen on Radio Power or on my website will come and join me this Sunday at 7. I'm going to be playing snippets from the press conference. And doing what I do from time to time, I'm going to be inviting my guest, George W. Bush. He doesn't appear much. In fact, this is his only third press conference, third primetime televised press conference in his entire presidency compared to, you know, Clinton having in the 40s, Eisenhower having in the 60s. This guy does not like to talk to the press, but he's coming on my show. At least in taped voice, he's coming on my show. And we're going to talk about the real press conference. We're going to tell you what George Bush is really thinking when he's saying the things that he's saying. And I'll be playing a taped interview, a taped press conference, in fact, from George Bush, along with my commentary so that you know that we have gone and entered his brain and found out what he really thinks. I hope you'll tune in this Sunday for that. But just to preview, one of the things I found most amusing, I guess, in the entire press conference is when one reporter asked him, he said, you know, President Bush, Mr. President, you have insisted that you have Vice President Dick Cheney by your side when you testify before the 9/11 Commission. They wanted to do it separately, but you wanted Vice President Cheney on your side. Why is that? To which George Bush entered a long answer about how it was important that he and Vice President Cheney give testimony to the commission. The reporter repeated him. You know, before he moved on to another question, said, yes, but Mr. President, my question is, why are you appearing together rather than separately? And again, George Bush said, oh, well, you know, I think it's important that we give testimony. The only thing the reporter could have done, and I wished he'd done it. I sometimes there's not enough courage, I guess, on the fact reporters. He just should have said, all right, if you don't want to answer my question, don't answer it. That would have been really fun. That would have been front page headlines. You know, Mr. Bush, I understand you just don't want to answer my question, and I respect your right to refuse to answer my question. That might even have gotten an answer. So sometimes I think the White House press corps is a little cowed. But we're going to talk at length today about the propaganda war. It's important, I think, to understand not just what's going on in Iraq, of which you can see a lot on the news, a lot of really grim stuff going on. But I think it's important to understand how we got into this mess and really the uses of propaganda, the uses of, you know, claiming weapons of mass destruction, the statue of Saddam Hussein. They came crumbling down. Was that mass support by Iraqis, or was that a few people, you know, put there by our group? It's important to go over this kind of stuff because, you know, we're hearing this public relations war now, and maybe if we saw what George Bush has done in the past with regard to Iraq, we might be a little less likely to believe. Now, I know you listeners, most of you already know that we can't trust our president's word. But still, it's important to know, and it's important to go into the details, because you may have to explain to a friend or a coworker or a family member who's not as clear and up on the facts as my listeners are, you know, how it is and why it is we can't trust every word that our president says. So that's why I'm very happy to have author Sheldon Hampton to come here to talk about his book, Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War in Iraq, to go through the entire history here, some of it predating George Bush, and really talk about why the press has followed right along, why are we finally seeing some criticism now. And I know that you folks will have questions. You should have questions about what we did in the past and what we're doing in the present. And as always, I invite you to join in and ask me questions. This is your show. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number. 877-57-SCOOP. For those who like numbers better than letters, it's 877-577-2667. And you can also send me an email. Send the emails to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Here's your chance to find out all you know or all you want to know or all you need to know about cherry-picking intelligence, about using images like a statue falling in the center of Baghdad or a plane landing on an aircraft carrier, a sign saying mission accomplished. How is it the president uses these images, uses embedded press, for example, putting the press in with the Pentagon, in with the soldiers? How does that manipulate our image of the war? Do we even see some of the horrors of the war? For example, some of the many cluster bombs that our troops have dropped. And what's interesting to me is also what they explore in the book, what Sheldon Rampton explores and his co-author John Stauber, is they explore the flip side of this entire question. They explore Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is kind of the Arab Fox News. And it uses just as many images and patriotism to Arabs to oppose the United States as we do. And it's really very interesting to explore their propaganda versus our propaganda. Ours is most, some is true, some is false. A lot of it is manipulation of the facts. and theirs. Some is true, some is false. Manipulation of the facts. Neither, I think it's fair to say, is a fair description of what's going on. And so it's very interesting when Sheldon Rampton explores what we do and what Fox News does. And then the flip side on Al Jazeera, where everything America does is bad. I really expect an interesting hour, and I hope you'll call in. Again, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can also send me an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. We'll be back with author Sheldon Rampton, author of Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War on Iraq, right after these messages.
A promotional letter from a Hummer dealer excitedly made this pitch. Allow me to introduce you to a fabulous opportunity. A tax loophole so big you could drive a Hummer H2 through it. I'm afraid he was not exaggerating. Tucked way down in the arcane language of one of George W.'s tax cuts for the rich was a provision that allows businesses to deduct up to $100,000 from their income taxes for the full cost of big SUVs. At a time when the federal deficit is bloating, at a time when we should be cutting back on the gluttonous consumption of foreign oil, at a time when pollution from cars is amassing a record level of the carbon dioxide gas that causes global warming, Washington has gouged a loophole into our tax laws that actively encourages people to avoid paying a big chunk of their taxes by buying the biggest, hoggiest gas guzzlers and pollution machines that exist in the entire auto kingdom. Bush's loophole literally requires buyers to go for the huge, most luxurious tanks on the road, Hummers, Range Rovers, Navigators, etc. The deduction only applies to vehicles weighing 6,000 pounds or more. Forget your zippy roadsters, your perky hybrids, your family sedans, your humble pickup trucks. To qualify for this tax break, your road machine has to be bigger than big. How big? Even the Ford Explorer or the Chevy Suburban does not qualify. An accountant tells of a client who was going to buy an Explorer, but by moving way up in price and weight to the yacht-like Lincoln Navigator, he was able to slip through Bush's loophole and save $20,000, meaning he got the bigger one for about the same as the Explorer would have cost, courtesy of us taxpayers. This is Jim Hightower saying, why should we be giving tax incentives to rich people so they can drive a glorified hog for their latte runs? To help shut down this loophole, call Taxpayers for Common Sense. 1-800-TAXPAYER.
I'll just see who that is then.
Oh no! South American killer bees! They're going for my eye!
A swarm of killer bees. That's one thing you don't want in your house. One thing you do want in your house is a better-looking roof with Plitanium plywood from Georgia-Pacific. Other roof sheathing materials can swell at the edges, creating an unsightly checkerboard pattern under your shingles. Plitanium roofs provide a more uniform surface. Plitanium plywood. Build it better.
While you can't see brilliant colors on the radio, you can use them in your business. That's why the Xerox WorkCenter M24 digital color copier printer is attractive to anyone who listens to the voice of reason. The lease price is a low $189 a month. You get brilliant Xerox color for less than 9 cents a page, plus the Xerox Total Satisfaction Guarantee. To get all the colors you can't see on the radio, do the most reasonable thing.
Call 1-800-ASK-XEROX for business lease details. Additional per copy charge.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about Bush's press conference last night, and I think it's a really opportune time to talk about it with our guest. His name is Sheldon Rampton. He's the author of Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda, and Bush's War on Iraq. And he'll be able to take your calls at 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send me an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Sheldon, thank you very much for coming on my program.
Thank you.
Let me ask you this. Did you see the press conference last night?
Actually, I didn't watch it, so...
Oh, okay. Well, let me tell you some of the things that that Bush said, because I think it's important. When I have flipped through your book here, and there's a lot of very interesting things in your book about you know, Bush using propaganda to support the war in Iraq. What's interesting to me is how he never really explained all the discrepancies. I mean, we were told we'd be greeted as liberators. We were told that, you know, the oil revenue would pay for it all. We were told that we wouldn't need many troops. And none of that's really come to pass. But in the press conference, he didn't want to talk about any of that. He just was talking about sort of staying the course and fighting the good fight and bringing democracy and freedom to Iraq. And I guess I don't see what happened at the press conference is that different from what I saw in your book. I want to, your book talks about just a number of things, and I want to just sort of go at them one by one. One of the things that it does is it begins talking about that famous statue in the center of Baghdad, that statue of Saddam Hussein that was torn down and really looked to be Americans, like a public uprising, you know, support for our troops. Can you give us the circumstances of what really happened in that square?
Sure. Well, I'm sure everyone in the audience remembers the images from that day. They were very iconic of a crowd gathered around the statue of Saddam Hussein. It was broadcast over and over on the news. It was compared to great events in history like, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall or Chinese students facing off tanks in Tiananmen Square. But what you really didn't see on television was the fact that the cameras were actually zoomed in pretty tight on the crowd because it was not a large crowd. Fardus Square, where that statue was pulled down, is quite a large public square, and there is footage that wasn't widely broadcast, and there are photographs of the square at the time the demonstration occurred. And there was a fairly small group of a few hundred people clustered just around the area of the statue. If you got further back than that, if the cameras had pulled back, you would have seen that the square itself was largely empty.
And my understanding is actually U.S. troops were keeping a number of people out of the square who wanted to go in, who weren't maybe so supportive.
The U.S. troops were clearly shepherding the events of the day and orchestrating things. And, you know, it ended up, in fact, that it was a U.S. military vehicle that pulled down the statue because the crowd was unable to pull it down for themselves. The thing people should understand about an event like that when they see it on television is that the U.S. military puts a lot of attention into what it calls psychological warfare or perception management. They regard the battle for hearts and minds both at home and abroad as being every bit as important as the military battle on the ground.
In fact, Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld was asked if he would ever lie to the press for propaganda purposes, and he kind of laughed as if that was ridiculous. I read that in your book as well, and yet you talk in the book about the Office of Strategic Influence. Tell our listeners what that is.
The Office of Strategic Influence is an outfit that was set up not long after September 11, and its purpose was to conduct information and even disinformation campaigns abroad. And what happened was that the brigadier general heading it up gave an interview with the New York Times in which he told them that the Office of Strategic Information envisioned a broad mission ranging from black campaigns that use disinformation and other covert activities to what they call white propaganda, which relies on truthful news releases. That created a little firestorm of controversy because even within the military, people worry that if you actually have a general saying, we're going to be doing disinformation, it tends to undermine the Pentagon's credibility, and it also blurs the boundaries between things like covert operations and public relations. So they quickly announced, Rumsfeld announced that you know, he said he'd never even heard of these plans to create the Office of Strategic Influence. And they disbanded it very quickly. 9 months later, though, Rumsfeld's on a plane flying to Chile, and he starts talking about it in front of reporters. He says, oh, and then there was that business about the Office of Strategic Influence, and everyone was complaining. And he says, You may recall that, and oh my goodness gracious, isn't that terrible? Henny Penny, the sky is going to fall. I'm quoting him here. And he says, I went down that day and said, fine, if you want to salvage this thing, fine, I'll give you the corpse. There's the name. You can have the name, but I'm going to keep doing every single thing that needs to be done, and I have. All they did was change the name.
It's so Orwellian. You know, the one phrase that I keep using, I've been using for a year since I've been on the air, this is the most Orwellian administration ever. What's interesting to me, though, is that despite the fact that this may be the most Orwellian administration, you point out in your book that this has been going on for a long time, that, in fact, one thing that my listeners know, but, well, maybe not all of them know, is our support of Saddam Hussein in the past. You know, it strikes me when the president got up at his press conference today and they were talking about the dangers of Saddam Hussein, and he said, he killed his own people. He killed his own people. But as you point out in the book, at the time he killed his own people, gassed them, a horrible, really vicious crime, we were supporting him. We were actually giving him anthrax and bubonic plague.
Yeah, you know, Richard Clark talked about that a little bit in his book, and Clark, contrary to what people have said about him recently, he's actually a fairly conservative guy, and in his book he gives a pretty good explanation of the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration's reasoning behind supporting Saddam Hussein, and he even defends it. He says, we thought that, you know, Iran was the real threat, and we were afraid, you know, of Iran-sponsored terrorism, and so we supported Iraq not because we thought Saddam Hussein was a good guy, but because we thought he was the lesser of two evils. Okay, that's
as far as it goes.
That's as far, you know, you can understand that reasoning as far as it goes, but the fact of the matter is that we were supporting Saddam Hussein when he was using chemical weapons against Iran and when he was using chemical weapons against his own people. It's really striking to me that, for example, shortly after Saddam Hussein's regime collapsed, Colin Powell went to the town of Halabja where you know, one of the worst chemical attacks against Iraqi Kurds occurred. You know, thousands of people were killed. And Powell made this speech where he said, this one attack with chemical weapons alone, it was such a gross violation of human rights that alone justifies invading Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
Right, justifies it 15 years later. I don't know if it would justify invading our own people in the United States who provided him with those weapons.
Right, but the thing I find so striking about that is that back at the time of Halabja when it happened, Colin Powell himself was one of the people then as a national security advisor to the Reagan administration who orchestrated giving up a pass to Iraq for gassing the Kurds at Halabja. There was a thing called the Prevention of Genocide Act of 1988 that passed unanimously in the U.S. Senate, and it was killed because the Reagan administration lobbied against it, and it was Colin Powell himself who led that campaign.
In fact, you point out in your book, it was actually Al Gore's bill, along with Jesse Helms and Claiborne Pell. They all passed together to condemn what was going on in Iraq, and you say that Colin Powell actually lobbied against it, as did Dick Cheney, you say in your book.
Right. So if that act was so criminal as to justify invading Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein, it should at least justify doing something to get rid of the people in this country, like Colin Powell and Dick Cheney, who helped make it possible and defended it after the fact when it was actually occurring.
In fact, another thing you put out in your book is that because we couldn't talk about the gassing of the Kurds when it occurred, because we were supporting them and we were against the policy of regime change. Iran wanted to change the regime in Iraq. We were against it at that time. You point out in your book that we had to make up something new. And so when Iraq went into Kuwait, there came this idea that babies were being thrown out of incubators. So my question for you is, was that story true? And if not, tell me how that story came about.
The babies from incubator story, John and I puzzled about that for a while at the time it happened. The babies from incubator story was basically a hoax that was cooked up by the Hill and Olson public relations firm, which was hired by the government in exile of Kuwait in the months and leading up to the, you know, Operation Desert Storm, to build U.S. support for going to war. The nation then, as it was in the build-up to the recent war in Iraq, was deeply divided and skeptical about whether we should go to war in the Middle East simply because Saddam Hussein had taken over a nearby country. And so Hill and Olson organized something called the Congressional Human Rights Caucus, which sounds like, if you hear the name, you think it sounds like the name of an official body of Congress. In fact, it's not. It had several members of Congress who sat on it, but it was not an official body of Congress. It was a group of Congress people who held an unofficial meeting in a government building. Excuse me. The significance of that is that it is, if it had actually been an official hearing, there are laws that forbid lying under oath. But since it was an unofficial meeting, they had much more leeway.
Interesting.
And they brought in a young girl, 14 years old, who said, "My name is Nayira, and I was volunteering in a hospital in Kuwait, and I, you know, had to flee the country, and I can't give you my last name because I'm afraid for the safety of my family who's still back in Kuwait." And she told this tearful story of while she was volunteering in the hospital, seeing the Iraqi soldiers come in and pull premature babies from incubators and steal the incubators and leave the babies to die on the cold hospital floor. And she described seeing dozens of infants killed in this way. Well, a couple of things were not mentioned in her testimony. One is that her family was actually not back in Kuwait. Her father was actually the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States and Canada, and her whole family was very safe. The real reason they didn't give her name was for that reason.
So she
didn't want to identify her affiliation with the Kuwaiti government. The second thing is that her story about babies being pulled from incubators just had no basis to it. After the war was over, groups that had believed the story, including U.S. and Canadian journalists and Amnesty International, which had included this story of babies being pulled from incubators in its human rights report, they went into the hospitals and interviewed medical personnel, hospital staff, and no one could remember anything like that happening. They interviewed one of the heads of staff at one of the Kuwaiti hospitals, and the guy said, "Well, I think that was just something for the propaganda. One human rights group, you know, went so far as to, you know, visit cemeteries and just, you know, extensively researched the story and couldn't find any basis for it whatsoever. It was, you know, simply a made-up story." And the question, of course, again, is why do you need to make up atrocity stories about Saddam Hussein? You know, the guy has lots of atrocities on his list of things he's done. The problem is that the atrocities for which he was actually guilty were things that he had done while he was a U.S. ally with support of the United States. And that's one of the things about propaganda that is worth noting, is that sometimes lies are told they take the form of not being entirely false, but they leave out important pieces of context.
Right. One of the things I find still amazing today is that we haven't seen more pictures of Don Rumsfeld shaking Saddam Hussein's hand in the 80s while that gassing was going on. I mean, we all know it occurred, but it just really isn't publicized very much. And I tell you, I want to take this discussion on into the present, because I think it's good background. I think people need to know what happened in the past. But let's move on to the present. Tell me how a public relations firm actually helped begin this war. Two things in your book I'd like you to talk about. One is PNAC, the Project for New American Century, and their plans for the war. And the other is how a public relations firm actually helped pick the Iraqi National Congress. If you could tell those two stories to my listeners.
Well, let me start with the Iraqi National Congress.
Okay.
At the end of Operation Desert Storm, the first President Bush issued a presidential directive ordering the Central Intelligence Agency to create conditions that would lead to the removal of Saddam Hussein. And one of the things that the CIA did was they hired a public relations firm known as the Rendon Group. The Rendon Group is a fairly secretive public relations firm that does a lot of contracting work. It accompanies U.S. military.
And again, it's hired by the CIA. They hired them.
Right.
Okay.
And what the Rendon Group did was they came up with a name for an Iraqi opposition group. They came up with the name Iraqi National Congress, which I think was probably chosen because it sounds a lot like African National Congress.
That makes sense.
But
very good
in any
public
case,
relations. Clever people there.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, it's the what they were supposed to do was things like excuse me, they organized a traveling human rights exhibit that depicted, you know, with, you know, photographs and things like that of Iraqi human rights violations. It was also intended to be sort of like the Contra project in Nicaragua. The Iraqi National Congress was going to stage actual military raids on targets inside Iraq for the purpose of destabilizing the government. They had the idea that that would lead to sufficient unrest that Saddam Hussein's own military officers would get rid of him.
And didn't Wolfowitz, who's today the Deputy Secretary of Defense, didn't he testify in 1998 that the Iraqi National Congress would actually help cause regime change in Iraq and there wouldn't be any need for United States troops?
Yeah, all through the 1990s, the idea was that this kind of, you know, funding of an internal Iraqi opposition was the right thing to do precisely because it would save us from having to send in U.S. troops. But what happened instead, which tends to happen with these kinds of things, is that the Iraqi National Congress became very adept at the game of politics in Washington at the same time that they were very inept at being a guerrilla army inside Iraq. Every time they tried a military operation inside Iraq, they just got crushed.
There's one very important name that I think that everyone listening to this broadcast should know, and I'd like you to tell us who Chalabi is. I think it's Ahmed Chalabi.
Ahmed Chalabi.
Okay.
Yeah, Chalabi was the guy that was chosen to head the Iraqi National Congress. He's a guy...
Chosen by whom, by the way?
Well, he was chosen... presumably by the people who put it together, which would be the Rendon Group and the CIA.
Okay.
But Chalabi is a guy who has what can safely be called a colorful past. He was born in Baghdad, but his family went into exile when he was 13 years old at the time that the monarchy was toppled in a coup shortly before the Ba'athist Party came to power. So he grew up in Jordan and Lebanon and England and the United States, attended the University of Chicago. He went on to establish the Petra Bank in Jordan in 1977, was a banker for 12 years until 1989, when...
Doesn't sound much like a freedom fighter.
Right. Well, what happened then is he had to flee Jordan because the bank was on the verge of collapse. The government of Jordan seized the bank and tried him in absentia. He actually fled the country. Some people say that he got driven out of the country in the trunk of someone's car to avoid arrest. But in any case...
Let me ask you to confirm some of the things I've been hearing from some of my sources on the Hill. What they're telling me is that a lot of our cherry-picked intelligence, a lot of the things that Bush used to go to war in Iraq were actually from Chalabi or his people. What do you know about that?
Right. That's the interesting thing about this is that the Iraqi National Congress was a sort... for a lot of the intelligence claiming that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, for the claims that there were links between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, and also for the claims that a U.S. invasion would be greeted, you know, by the Iraqi people and we would be greeted as liberators. All of those, you know, Chalabi on television once said he didn't think there would be enough flowers in Iraq to greet the American troops as liberators.
Wow.
That they'd run out of flowers, and we wouldn't know what to do with all the flowers they would shower upon us.
You know, that's such a severe problem in Iraq today, running out of flowers to greet us. It's a real serious problem.
But it's been good for the forest.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Hey, Sheldon, we got to go to commercial break, but when we come back, I want to discuss, bring the war up to date. I want to discuss weapons of mass destruction, why we thought, or at least why Bush said that they had them. All these things that Chalabi told us, why we'd be, you know, greeted as liberators, that oil revenues would cover it all, and basically how the Iraqi campaign was sold to the American people. And I hope you'll join in this discussion. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. Toll free, 877-57-SCOOP. Here's your chance to ask Sheldon Rampton whatever you want about the Bush propaganda campaign in Iraq. 877-57-SCOOP, or you can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. We'll be back with more of the Inside Scoop right after these messages.
Job growth surges in March, blared the headlines, and what a rose-colored rush of self-congratulation ensued. George W. gloated like the boy who stuck in his thumb and pulled out a plum. Economists were high-fiving each other. Editorialists hailed the new boom. And you'd have thought the bluebird of happiness was singing in every backyard. But even as Bush strutted atop a made-for-TV platform that his staff had emblazoned with the slogan, "Strengthening America's Economy," the whole scene had a false feel to it, eerily similar to George's strut in his Top Gun costume last year aboard that aircraft carrier that his staff had emblazoned with the declaration, "Mission accomplished" in Iraq. Just as our troops are still mired in that bloody war, so are most Americans still mired in a low-wage economy that can't be fixed by presidential strut. For the powers that be to celebrate the addition of 300,000 jobs is ludicrous in an economy that has lost more than 2 million jobs since Bush took office and that continues to offshore our best-paying jobs. If you peek beneath the headlines, you'll find that the number of out-of-work Americans actually went up by 200,000 in March, and the number of underemployed, those wanting full-time work but only getting part-time jobs, was up by 300,000. Also, of the ballyhooed new jobs that Bush claims to have created in March, nearly 50,000 are not new at all. They're the jobs of California supermarket workers who had been on strike and have now returned to their old jobs. Worse, what Bush and the powers that be don't want us noticing is that nearly all of March's job creation was in low-wage, no-benefit work that cannot sustain a middle-class way of life. Indeed, despite the gloating over March's job stats, average weekly earnings went down in March. This is Jim Hightower saying, the real issue is not job numbers, but the decline in good jobs, the very lifeblood of America's middle class.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
While you can't see brilliant colors on the radio, you can use them in your business. That's why the Xerox WorkCenter M24 digital color copier printer is attractive to anyone who listens to the voice of reason. The lease price is a low $189 a month. You get brilliant Xerox color for less than 9 cents a page, plus the Xerox Total Satisfaction Guarantee. To get all the colors you can't see on the radio, do the most reasonable thing.
Call 1-800-ASK-XEROX for business lease details. Additional per copy charge.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're discussing the uses of propaganda in Bush's campaign on Iraq. And I've got here author Sheldon Rampton, and he's telling us some of the history here. And we're moving on to the present now to discuss, you know, where these things came from, where this propaganda came from, how it was not just, truth, if you will, but a very coordinated campaign to get a certain story out there. And then moving on to the end of the hour, we're going to talk about really the flip side of this, about Al Jazeera, the Arab network, that kind of does the same thing that we're doing against us on the other side, and maybe try to find some way to sort through all this propaganda and bring some truth. I don't know how, but the number is 877-57-SCOOP if you want to join in. We'll get your calls in a little bit. 877-57-SCOOP. You can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Sheldon, let's talk about weapons of mass destruction, because I think that's the heart of really Bush's claim that turned out not to be true in Iraq. One of the things you point out in your book that I think has gotten very little press is the testimony, or at least I don't know if it's testimony or just what he said, of Hussein Kamel, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, defector. Tell us what he said about weapons of mass destruction.
Well, Hussein Kamel actually defected to Jordan in 1995, and his testimony was widely cited by the Bush administration as evidence that Iraq could not be trusted to tell the truth about its weapons programs, because at the time that Kamel defected, Iraq was keeping a bunch of secrets, and they were afraid that he would spill the beans, so they disclosed a bunch of information they hadn't disclosed previously about their weapons programs, and those were investigated and so forth. But the main thing that Kamel said that the Bush administration conveniently left out when it was talking about the issue of weapons of mass destruction is that Kamel told them that all the weapons programs had been destroyed shortly after Operation Desert Storm.
Now, this is really important, folks. I just have to underline this. Make sure you understand what you're hearing. We had Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, a guy at the very top of the Iraqi government, defecting to Jordan, telling the Bush administration that all weapons of mass destruction had been destroyed. Now, I mean, let's say, Sheldon, I mean, that maybe they wouldn't believe him. I mean, did they have any reason to trust what he had to say?
Well, you know, I mean, anyone who defects, you know, tends to tell the interrogators what they want to hear. It's well understood in the intelligence circles that you can't simply trust what a defector has to say. The point is...
Although, in this case, the interrogators wanted to hear that there were weapons of mass destruction, so he didn't tell them what he wanted to hear. So that may make it more likely to be truthful. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, sure. But the point is that whether they absolutely knew that what he told them back then was credible. The point is that the Bush administration very selectively told the parts of the intelligence picture that made it look like Iraq had these stockpiles of weapons, while leaving out the parts that raise question about that. And Kamel is certainly someone, he told them very emphatically about chemical, biological, nuclear weapons, that they were all destroyed, and he gave them a good reason why they destroyed them after the Gulf War. He said, you know, we couldn't use them during the Gulf War because we knew if we used them that the U.S. retaliation would be nuclear. So,
folks, every time you hear a conservative tell you, well, everybody thought Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, even the Clinton administration thought so, you just say these two words, Hussein Kamel. Make them go to Google and look it up, because it's important that we know that the Bush administration had plenty of contrary evidence that there weren't weapons of mass destruction. I want to move on, though, to the question of when the war started. You point out that it was sort of sold like soap in September of 2002. I remember in August 2002, they talked about, you know, whether they would bring the war up from Iraq. I mean, I remember, and it's funny how Orwellian it is, how the government kind of tries to play with your memories, even. But I remember thinking when they brought up the war in Iraq, where's this coming from? I understand Afghanistan. I understand why we're fighting there. Where is this war in Iraq coming from? And I remember finding out in Congress that, Andy Card, Bush's chief of staff, didn't want, or Karl Rove, more importantly, didn't want this war to come out in August of 2002 because you can't introduce a new product in August.
Right.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, Andrew Card, of course, has a background as an executive with General Motors, so it's kind of natural for him to turn to marketing metaphors in describing things. But, you know, what that underlines is that the Bush administration had Iraq in its sights long before the public push for war began in fall of 2002. And, in fact, it's become increasingly clear that Iraq was on their to-do list from even before Bush took office.
In fact, Paul O'Neill's book, Ron Susskind's book, The Price of Loyalty, actually provides the documents, the top secret documents, where Bush is splitting up the Iraqi oil fields just about a week after he's elected. Tell us, Sheldon, about the connection or lack thereof between Iraq and September 11th and how the administration tried to promote that connection.
Yeah, we have a chapter in our book in the title True Lies, in which we look at that, because of all the deceptive things that happened during the build-up to war, I think the insinuations about the connection to 9/11 were the most deliberately and patently deceptive things that the Bush administration did. One of the things they did, for example, was they played up rumors about an alleged meeting that Mohammed Atta, one of the 9/11 hijackers, had with an Iraqi diplomat. According to this story, supposedly Mohammed Atta had met with this Iraqi diplomat in Prague in the Czech Republic not long before before 9/11. When I say not long, about 9 months previously. The story of that alleged meeting, though, came when someone living in Prague saw a picture of Mohammed Atta on TV and said, "That looks like someone I seem to remember who might have met with this Iraqi diplomat." And so he brought that information to the attention of Czech authorities.
So that's the heart of it. That's the heart of the connection. One guy in Czechoslovakia thought some guy on TV looked like a guy he might have met.
that he might have seen.
That's
right.
that's our huge connection that Cheney says is bulletproof.
Right, and it turns out, in fact, that the Iraqi diplomat had business dealings with a car dealer from Germany who just happened to bear a striking resemblance to Mohammed Atta. So that's probably what this guy saw. But and the Czech officials investigated it. The FBI investigated it extensively. I mean, they spent you know tens of thousands of man hours putting together every piece of information they had about the movements of Mohammed Atta and the other hijackers while they were in the United States. And they found that Otto was in the United States throughout the period when this guy in the Czech Republic thought that he had seen this guy in Prague.
Yeah, they even had Florida rental car records. Let me give the number out again. I'd appreciate your calls. It's 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can email me to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Okay, Sheldon, the war is now started. We've got our war started. And I'd like to talk about the coverage of the war and, again, the use of propaganda. And there's so many examples of this, that, you know, the embedded reporters, Jessica Lynch, what we did show. And then, of course, the things we didn't show, things like cluster bombs. Take any topic you want from that.
Well, you know, we finished the book with a chapter called As Others See Us. And we begin by describing that publicity stunt where Bush flew that plane, that fighter jet in and landed on a fighter deck. That event, of course, was very carefully staged. They did everything down to, they wanted to minimize wind noise while Bush gave his speech aboard the aircraft carrier, so they actually had the aircraft carrier adjust its speed in the water to keep pace with the wind so that there wouldn't be wind blowing into his microphone. That's
wow.
How carefully.
That's impressive.
Yeah, I mean, you got to give them credit for paying
attention to detail. Right, absolutely.
That kind of detail, anyway.
Tell us about Jessica Lynch, because that was an interesting talk about a propaganda story. Jessica Lynch herself denies the story. I mean, the story originally, I think, was that, you know, she sort of went down fighting and that they stormed the hospital to save her. And Jessica Lynch herself, to her credit, and that, by the way, to me, does make her an American hero. When someone who tells the truth and says, you know what, I'm not really a hero, that makes them a hero. How is Jessica Lynch used?
Well, Jessica Lynch is the sort of person, I mean, she's blonde, she's photogenic, she seems like a nice person. She's the sort of, and she's female, which means that
chivalry can save the day.
You know, it brings out these feelings of chivalry in us. It's striking that, for example, there was a black woman who was also briefly a prisoner and seriously injured. I think her name was Shoshana Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And she got very little attention, and I think really there's a racial component to that, that it's harder to get people sympathetic to a black woman than to a pretty blonde woman. But Jessica Lynch became kind of the ideal symbol of the kind of purity and nobility of our soldiers and the innocence, partly because, you know, being female and attractive brings up that kind of, helps cement that kind of image. But
unfortunately, the story told about her wasn't true.
Just about everything that was said about her turns out to be false. I mean, she was in a situation that, you know, where she was in harm's way and you know, like the soldiers are, but she didn't fight. She went down, she was injured by her vehicle crashing,
and she wasn't imprisoned in the hospital, was she?
She was receiving treatment in the hospital. The group that rescued her, incidentally, and that filmed it, was a special Pentagon military unit that's called Combat Camera. So in that case, all the footage of her rescue was actually filmed by the military itself.
It's kind of like Cops, I guess. You know, the cops don't usually look too bad in the Cops program.
Right.
Hey, Sheldon, I got to take one more commercial, but when we come back, I want to finish up with talking about the difference between our press and our propaganda and what the other side is doing, what the Arabic press is doing in Al Jazeera, and the similarities and differences between there. If you want to call in, the number is 877-57-SCOOP. We always appreciate your calls here on the Inside Scoop. And you can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Back with the conclusion of the Inside Scoop right after these messages.
Oh. This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Even though top executives at U.S. Airways are threatening the airline may descend back into bankruptcy unless its workforce makes another round of wage and benefit concessions, the need for cuts does not seem to apply to the executives themselves. U.S. Airways is trying to wring another $1.5 billion of concessions out of its primarily union workforce, this on top of a similar amount of concessions made over the last year. If they don't do so, and soon, says CEO David Siegel, another Chapter 11 filing may follow. Yet, when U.S. Airways released its annual proxy statement on Friday, guess who made out big time last year? CEO David Siegel, who was awarded a compensation package in 2003, which, depending on how you value the stock options included, is worth between $9 and $11 million. A spokesman for the airline says Siegel got only $700,000 in cash last year, and unlike most executive stock grants, which are redeemable immediately, Siegel must wait until next year to really start cashing in.
Good news for three Czech journalists kidnapped in Iraq. The Iraqi Minister of Culture said they are alive and well and could be released as early as today. The three men had been missing since Sunday, when they were taken hostage by rebels west of the town of Fallujah. The Czech government has advised all of its citizens to leave Iraq immediately.
Tyson Foods has been fined $436,000 for health and safety violations at an Arkansas rendering plant where a worker suffocated on the job last year. 31-year-old Jason Edward Kelly died while trying to plug leaks in a system which bleeds off toxic gases created by decomposing chicken scraps that end up as pet food. The Federal Occupational Health and Safety Administration cited Tyson with 19 violations of safety regulations in connection with Kelly's death. 17 of them were classified either willful or serious. According to OSHA, workers at the plant had little or no knowledge of the dangers they faced there. Tyson plans to dispute the fine.
400 hotel workers in St. Louis have joined Local 74 of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union. The employees work at the Renaissance Grand and Renaissance Suites hotels, which are part of a $270 million Marriott convention complex, making it the largest unionized hotel in the St. Louis metro area.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. What's a good way for U.S. corporations to hide their assets from the IRS? Invest them in overseas subsidiaries. As corporate taxes have been falling for the last few years, the amount of money companies keep elsewhere has grown as well. The most reliable estimate of how much U.S. corporate income may actually be stashed away is $12 billion annually, although it's generally believed that figure is on the low side at best.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking with author Sheldon Rampton. He's one of the two authors of the book Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War in Iraq. And I think it's important now that we've heard Bush in the press conference last night to understand how this war started and, you know, how it is that the Bush administration has been using propaganda. And then later on, the last few minutes, I want to talk about how and why America's press follows that propaganda without much complaint and how, frankly, the Arabs do the same on their end. But first, Sheldon, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get your book? I assume it's on Amazon.com and all the normal book sellers' places?
Sure. They just have to know the title, which is Weapons of Mass Deception. Not Weapons of Mass Destruction. A lot of people, when I'm on the radio, a lot of radio hosts introduced me as author of Weapons of Mass Destruction, and so I have to correct them fairly often. It's Weapons of Mass Deception,
okay,
which is pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, well, particularly in this case. So look for it on Amazon.com or any other place you might buy books, Weapons of Mass Deception. I'll tell you.
It should be in bookstores, too.
It's on bookstores, too, Borders, I'll tell you, it's a real good read. I read it. It's a quick, easy read, lots of very interesting facts, some of which you're hearing here. We can't talk about them all. And I really encourage you to go out and buy the book. One of the things that you mentioned in the book that really was very interesting to me is how and why our press is so cowed. And that, here we've talked at length about all the lies the administration is giving us. Why do you think our press is just lapping it up and transmitting it to us?
Well, I think every country's media tends to some degree, reflect the foreign policy line of its government. It happens for different reasons in different countries and to different degrees. but I think it was also that was also exaggerated in this country as a response to September 11. You know, when you have a crisis in a country, this happens everywhere. The natural response of the public in that country is to rally around their leaders, and that's also reflected in the media. The media is acutely sensitive to market pressures from its audience. And, you know, right after September 11, Bush's popularity shot up over 90%, which is almost unprecedented for a president. It wasn't because there was something really great had happened, something terrible had happened, but because people in a moment like that want desperately to believe that their leaders
are telling you the truth.
Are on top of things,
yep.
They're wise and strong and doing the right thing. And so we had a period for a good year and a half at least, 2 years probably, when the media was largely uncritical and afraid to be critical and to take an independent approach towards Bush. I think that's the number one factor.
Sean, let me go quickly to a caller. We only have a few minutes left. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your name and where are you from?
This is Edward from New York.
What's your question or comment, Edward?
I'd like to ask Sheldon, we've heard some things about Saddam Hussein and donating money to Hamas. Does his book get into that, and can you tell us what was the connection between Saddam Hussein and Hamas?
Good question. Thanks very much for your call, Edward. Do you know what the connection was between Saddam Hussein and Hamas, Sheldon?
You know, our book does not explore that. My understanding is that Saddam Hussein had a standing offer that he would donate a certain amount of money to the family of anyone who died as a suicide bomber in Iraq, and that was the connection. And a number of other Arab governments do similar things.
That was exactly my point.
Charitable
right,
activities for the families.
A lot of Arab countries donate to Hamas, Saddam Hussein, Saudi Arabia. One of the things that struck me is last night I heard Bush on television say how it sickens him to see, you know, dead people on television. And I'm thinking to myself, I did a show on the genocide in Sudan. That's not on television, so I guess Bush isn't sickened by that, so he doesn't do anything by that. Before we close, I just want you very briefly to tell us about the flip side of the coin. You actually have some really interesting stuff in your book about Al Jazeera, the Arab network that does propaganda, very similar. You call it the Arab Fox News, and to me that just rang a bell. How is Al Jazeera the Arab Fox News?
Well, just as Fox News offers you this kind of unrelenting pro-Bush, you know, pro-war perspective on things, Al Jazeera offers kind of an unrelentingly critical perspective towards U.S. actions and towards Israel. So one of the, for example, take the phrase weapons of mass destruction. In the United States, that was used in reference to alleged Iraqi chemical and biological weapons. In the Arab media, that same phrase was used in reference to U.S. cluster bombs being used during the war in Iraq.
And I'll bet most Americans don't even know we used cluster bombs.
No, and that's, you know, each of these media offers a sort of propaganda slice of reality with a heavy dose of propaganda mixed in. I think, and we don't see certain things in our media, they don't see certain things in theirs. I think the only way that you can approximate a sense of what's going on is to sample some of what's coming from different media and compare them against one another. And you're right, we didn't have any reporting to speak of at all about cluster bombs in the United States.
That's a good point.
Europe.
Last question, Sheldon. We only got about a minute left. Tell me why you think the opposition to the war, particularly in your book at the outset, I think it's greater now, but at the outset you mentioned how the opposition mostly came from celebrities. It didn't come much from politicians, and that stations like Clear Channel got rid of, you know, existed, that Donahue got kicked off the air. Why is it that the opposition to the war wasn't more striking in the press?
Well, I think it's, again, an example of the press selectively reporting on things. There was plenty of opposition to the war from different sectors of American society, including conservatives, including university academics who specialized in studying the Middle East and knew that this would lead to a disaster. But the media selectively put two types of people on the air as representatives of anti-war views. One was celebrities like Janine Garofalo or Sean Penn, who could sort of be easily dismissed as, you know, know-nothing Hollywood actor types. And the other people they would put on the air would be brief shots from a distance of scruffy-looking demonstrators at protest rallies.
They didn't put in the mainstream politicians.
And intellectuals,
yep.
and so forth. And so it gave a sense that anti-war people were really not serious.
Sheldon, I want to thank you. Boy, an hour does go fast. Thank you so much for appearing on my show. I think you gave some really terrific evidence and points and facts for people to know how propaganda is used. And it's vital that we understand going forward some of the way propaganda was used in the past. Thanks very much for coming on my show, Sheldon.
Thank you.
And I encourage everyone to go out and buy the book, Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War on Iraq. I also want to encourage you to support Inside Scoop. You can do that, one, by, if you're listening on Radio Power, to give a donation to Radio Power. It's a listener-sponsored stream, and that's how you can help me out. You can help Radio Power out. You can also help out the Inside Scoop by advertising here on the Inside Scoop, sponsor a show. There's all kinds of ways. Or maybe tell a local radio station that they need to get the Inside Scoop. Again, it's our goal to provide you with information that you can't get in the mainstream media. We talked at length about how the press was manipulated by the Bush administration, and it's only on radio shows like these that you can get the facts behind the facts. And again, I try every show to give you lots of facts, things that you can tell your friends, your family, people who don't know the underlying facts. When they say, oh, well, aren't you glad Saddam Hussein is gone? You can point out, well, you know, he was a bad guy, but there were worse guys, and it was manipulated, and there, you know, Hussein Kamel said there were no weapons of mass destruction, so we were cherry-picking intelligence, and we do this propaganda all the time, and we use cluster bombs, and in fact, our enemies are doing the same thing, and that you can't really complain about Al Jazeera unless you also complain about Fox News. So this is Mark Levine signing off on the Inside Scoop. Tomorrow we've got a terrific show, Beyond the Abortion Debate. Our guest will be Dr. Frank Boehm. Dr. Boehm is a doctor who performs abortions. He describes himself as pro-choice, but he thinks there are limits. And, you know, a lot of times you think you know everything there is to know about abortion, but there is a middle, at least Dr. Boehm argues, in the abortion debate. I expect a terrific show tomorrow. And then coming up Sunday at our new time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, 4 Pacific, we're going to go over the Bush press conference and tell you what he's really thinking. This is Mark Levine signing off until tomorrow from the Inside Scoop. As we